The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I'll continue with the readings of the works of Joyce Carol Oates in the New Yorker magazine. A short story in the fiction section of the October 24th, 1994 issue, Zombie, by Joyce Carol Oates. My name is QP, and I am 29 years old, 3 months. I see my probation officer, Mr. T, Thursdays, 10 a.m., and my therapist, Dr. E, Mondays and Thursdays, 4:30 p.m., My group therapy session with Dr. B is Tuesdays, 7 to 8:30 p.m. I am a registered student at Dale County Business College, where I am enrolled in 2 3-credit courses for the spring semester, Introduction to Accounting and Computer Graphics. My address is 118 Church Street, Mount Vernon, Michigan, which is close by the State University campus. 7 miles from Dale, but no inconvenience for me. I have my van. I drive everywhere in my Ford van. It is a 1987 model, no longer new, but reliable. My American flag decal in the rear window. At 118 Church Street, I am caretaker for a rental property. The house is a tall, narrow, red brick Victorian with a smudged look like somebody moved his thumb across it. It is 3 stories high, with an attic and a deep cellar with a stone foundation, in which, at the front, the date 1892 is chiseled. University students rent our rooms. As caretaker of the property, I live in the ground floor rear, because that is most convenient. The stairs to the cellar are close by, and nobody can get to them except by passing my door. My tools and equipment and workbench are in the cellar. But I have access to all the floors, of course, because I am caretaker. And I am grateful for this. My master key will open the door to any room in the house. Most of the students who rent with us are foreign students from India, China, Pakistan, Africa. Often they have trouble with their locks at first, so I am called upon to help, and am always obliging, though speaking no more than is necessary, and making no eye contact. All the houses on Church Street are old, spacious Victorians. They used to be single-family residences. Now they're rooming houses like ours, or office buildings. QP Caretaker is neatly printed on a small white card beside my door. I printed it myself in black ink. Last night, I was working late in the cellar, repairing seepage damage in the cistern. I am a hard worker once I get started, and lose track of time. I did not require sleep. I did not take my 10 p.m. medication. So sometime in the middle of the night, I climbed to the attic and looked out the window at the night sky where there was a moon so bright it hurt my eyes. Shreds of cloud being blown across the moon clotted and cobwebbed like angry thoughts. "So shameful," Dad said. "But now we are going to turn over a new leaf, aren't we, son?" My father is a distinguished physicist at the university. I know it has been upsetting to him to learn certain things about his only son and to have these things a matter of public record. "How does your client plead?" Judge L. asked, and my lawyer said, "Your Honor, my client pleads guilty." In my heart, I did not plead guilty because I was not guilty and am not. But it was a racial matter, too. The boy is black and QP is white. What can you do? So my lawyer counseled me. But I am on good terms with the family again. This is a relief to me. I have told them how sorry I am that I have hurt them, and how much it means to me that they trust me. "I will live up to your trust from now on," I told them. It's hard for me to hug them, especially Dad. There is a stiffness in all our bones, but I do it, and I believe I am doing it correctly. Mom and Big Sis were crying, and there was a stinging moisture in my eyes. When Judge L. pronounced 2 years, there was a long moment when my heart stopped before he added, "suspended sentence." His eyes, which I had no choice, my lawyer counseled me, but to look at, reflected severity, but also kindness. Judge L. is known to Dad, and Dad is known to Judge L. Mount Vernon is not a small city, but important men know one another here as elsewhere, I believe. Afterward, Dad shook my hand so hard it hurt and did embrace me, and there were tears in his eyes behind his glasses. Now we are all going to turn over a new leaf. You get to the attic by steep stairs at the rear of the third floor corridor. I made my way silently in wool socks, not wishing to wake up the young Pakistani graduate student whose room is almost under the stairs. Ramid would not be a safe specimen, or any of them beneath this roof. I never think of it. In the attic there was a strong, sharp smell of dust and the sweetish, sour odor of dead mice. I inhaled deeply, shining my flashlight into the attic's corners. Shadows leap like bats. When light moves, shadows leap. I'm not so comfortable in the attic as in the cellar, where I have my things. The space in the attic is like certain dreams I had in the detention center, where shapes meant to be solid start to melt, and there is no control. Unlike the cellar, which is safe underground, the attic is four stories above ground. The concentration of cosmic rays is higher at higher elevations on Earth. The landlord made the suggestion last Sunday that I clean out the attic to reduce the fire hazard, and I will get to that soon. The cellar is my number one priority right now, but I will get to the attic next. Now we are going to turn over a new leaf, son, aren't we? And I said, yes, Dad. The idea of creating a zombie for my own purposes came to me in a brainstorm 5 years ago. Yes. At such rare times, you can feel the electrically charged neurons of the prefrontal brain realigning themselves like iron filings drawn by a magnet. The Earth is continually bombarded by high-speed cosmic rays. A voice was lecturing. An amplified voice I did not even recognize at first was Dad's. Cosmic rays from outer space, from a distance of millions of light years. More concentrated at higher elevations. It was a darkened lecture amphitheater at the university where I had hidden myself to hear Professor R.P. lecture to his students. Perhaps I was seeking some knowledge or some secret. I must have nodded off in the back row, and when I woke up, I did not know where I was at first, which happened sometimes then when I was not so much in control of myself and going for as long as 48 hours unsleeping and then crashing wherever I might be. If Dad saw me there amid his many students, he gave no sign, of course. But he could not see me, I am sure, in the darkness. On an illuminated screen at the front of the amphitheater was a computer simulation of a section of the universe 200 million light-years across, indicating how the universe evolved from its early smoothness and equitable distribution of matter to the present condition of superclusters, galaxies, and dark matter. As much as 90% of the universe's mass is in unseen black holes. Most of the universe is therefore undetectable by our instruments and may not obey the laws of physics as we know them. Professor R.P.'s several hundred students were busy taking notes. It came to me that any one of them, almost, would be a suitable specimen for a zombie. Except you would want a healthy young person, male. You would want somebody with fight and vigor in him. But the university students have always been forbidden to me after that first and only ignorant incident that, lucky for QP, turned out okay. It was dark behind the dorm, and the kid was drunk and stooped over, vomiting and gagging. And when he glanced up, hearing me, the tire iron slammed down over his ear, crashing him to the ground before he could really register seeing me. So it was okay. I was wearing my hooded jacket, and there were no witnesses. Yet I panicked and ran as I would never do now. But it was okay. A lesson was learned. The fact is, any university student, with the possible exception of certain of the foreign students who are so far from home, would be immediately missed. Their families care about them, and they have families. A safer specimen for a zombie would be somebody from out of town, a hitchhiker or a drifter or a junkie, if in good condition, or from the black projects downtown. Somebody nobody gives a damn for, somebody who should never have been born. I hurried straight from the amphitheater to the psych library to look up the surgical method, lobotomy. This is why. Seeing the universe like that, you see how futile it is to believe that any galaxy matters, let alone any star of any galaxy, or any planet the size of not even a grain of sand in all that void. Yet, alone any continent, or any nation, or any state, or any county, or any city, or any individual. The idea came to me at that time, too, because I was having trouble keeping my penis hard with guys' awake eyes observing me in intimate quarters. I was living in my two-room place on 12th Street at Reardon, which was my first real place away from Dale Springs, and I was working for a moving company, or maybe I had just quit that time. Dad dropped by. Age 24 and time to be on my own, I told them, and I meant it. The week after Labor Day, 1989, Bunny Gloves had been missing 12 days, but there was never anything in the Mount Vernon Gazette or on the local TV. Why would there be? Set out from Detroit to Minnesota, and not a trace. Many hundreds, thousands in a single year. Like sparrows of the air, they fly and fall and disappear, and not a trace. Dale Springs is where Dad and Mom and my sister Ruthie live and where QP grew up, a suburb of Mount Vernon, 6 miles west of the university. Downtown Mount Vernon is 5 miles to the south, yet Dad said he had dropped by to visit me. The rapping at the door. My eyes flew open and my heart beat in a cold panic because now was not the time. I called out something and was up from the bed, stumbling, pulling on my trousers, zipping up, dragging the khaki blanket up over the cot, the stained sheets, the sweet, stale smell. "Okay," I said, "I'm cool, okay." And it was Dad, my dad, dropped by to see how I was. The chain latch was on the door. Good thing, because when I turned the knob, there was Dr. R.P. in the crack, smiling, wearing his sand-colored corduroy face, with his tweed a-hole of a mouth and his glistening white dentures in the crack of the door. I fumbled, opening the door. Dad's eyes, a few inches away. Out of a dream of bunny gloves and fondling, his voice as it was before the change in it, and eyes muddy green as knowing deepened in them, and the pupils shrank to pinpricks. "Quentin, hello, am I disturbing you?" Dad filled the doorway, staring and breathless from the stairs, his black plastic professor glasses riding the bridge of his nose. When his professor goatee went from brown to gray, he shaved it, but there is the shadow of the goatee on his face. "Son?" Asked how I was, and I said, and how was he, and things at home, and Mom and Ruthie send their love, and the eyes darting sidelong and the nostrils widening. A pause. And then asking, "That smell, son, what is it?" "Smell?" I was standing, blocking Dad's view, but could not block his capacity for sniffing, smelling. I looked vague and surprised, looking about the room as if I might see the smell. "Just some gym things, Dad. Sweaty socks, jogging shoes, towels, and stuff like that." Dad asked, so reasonable, "Where's it coming from?" "Coming from? Under your bed? My bed?" Dad made a move, but I was blocking his way. His face was beginning to go red in that way of an old man's face blotching in patches. He said, "It's more than gym things. It smells like garbage. You don't have raw garbage in here, son, do you?" Distinguished professor of physics, former chair of the department and a senior fellow of the Michigan State Institute of Advanced Research. That time Dad came to get me where I was doing homework upstairs in my room. I was 12 years old in 7th grade. He yanked me by the arm downstairs and into the garage to show me the magazines and other stuff I had hidden behind stacks of old newspapers that he had found. And his face splotched and furious. And at that time, he did wear a goatee, and this, too, seemed livid with outrage. twisting the magazines in his hands to spare himself the sight of the covers and the drawing somebody had done on them in red felt pen, and the insides with more such drawings on centerfold models of male muscle bodies and parts of certain photos scissored out. "This is sick, Quentin. This is disgusting. I never want to see anything like this again. We won't tell your mother." Starting to say more, but his voice gave out. Together we burned the evidence, back behind the garage, where Mom would not see. He was looking at me like that now, Dad's eyes behind his shiny glasses. He was 54 years old, with hairy black nostrils widening and contracting and widening like a fish's gills. "How can you live in such squalor, son? It's so hard for me to comprehend." Between my bed springs and the mattress were the fishing knife and the others, but I could not make a sudden move to get them. I was staring at my hands, which were trembling as if the building were vibrating from traffic. I did wonder, could I strangle Dad? But he would put up a struggle, and he is strong, and we would be so close. I was staring at my hands as if I had never seen them before, seeing the fingers were stubby and the nails uneven and broken and edged with grime. How many times I had scrubbed my hands with soap and cleaned the nails with a knife blade, and yet it had all come back. And then the answer came to me. "I bet I know what it is, Dad, a dead rat." "A dead rat? Or a mouse, or maybe a mice." "There are dead mice in here?" Dad's face was contorted with disgust. I said, trying not to stammer, No, it's not the way you and Mom brought me up, Dad. I'm sorry." "Quentin, how long has it been like this in this room?"
"Not long, Dad, a day or two."
"Aren't you bothered by it yourself?"
"I'm going to do some cleaning this weekend."
"You sleep in here in this smell, Quentin, and you're not bothered?"
"I am bothered, Dad. I just don't get uptight about it."
"It's very disturbing to me, son, that you might be lying to me."
"Well, I don't mean to lie, Dad. I just don't know what you're asking."
"I'm asking if something is under your bed or in those bedclothes on the floor and why it smells. You know what I'm asking."
"Apart from the mice, Dad," I said, "I don't know what you're asking."
It went on like that. Dad's mouth shaped certain words and my mouth shaped certain words, and it was familiar to me, and there was a comfort in that. Finally, he gave up, as he always has given up, and he asked, "Quentin, how would you like to come home for dinner tonight?" And I said, "Thanks, Dad, but I'm not hungry, I guess. I've already eaten." Frontal lobotomy, irreversible psychosurgical procedure in which nerve fibers in the frontal lobes of the brain are severed by incision for the alleged relief of mental agitation, compulsive mental cognition, and physical behavior in schizophrenics and other emotionally disturbed persons. This page I tore out of the textbooks. I could almost see my zombie materializing before my eyes. Also from Psychosurgery, published in 1942 by Dr. Walter Freeman of George Washington University. When the patient is unconscious, I pinch the upper eyelid between thumb and finger and bring it well away from the eyeball. I then insert the point of the transorbital leucotome into the conjunctival sac, taking care not to touch the skin or lashes, and move the point around until it settles against the vault of the orbit. I then drop to one knee beside the table in order to aim the instrument parallel with the bony ridge of the nose and slightly toward the midline. When the 5-centimeter mark is reached, I pull the handle of the instrument as far laterally as the rim of the orbit will permit in order to sever fibers at the base of the frontal lobe. I then return the instrument halfway to its previous position and drive it further to a depth of 7 centimeters from the margin of the upper eyelid. Again, I sight the instrument as carefully as possible and take a profile photograph of it in this position. This is the nearest approach to precision of which the method can boast. Then comes the ticklish part. Arteries are within reach. Keeping the instrument in the frontal plane, I move it 15 degrees to 20 degrees medially and about 30 degrees laterally, returning it to the mid position, and withdraw by a twisting movement,
at the same time exercising considerable pressure on the eyelids to prevent hemorrhage. Then, to the opposite side, using an identical instrument, but freshly sterilized. There were several diagrams of the procedure of the transorbital lobotomy, and I ripped these out too. Mom and Dad had hoped for me to become a scientist like Dad, or a doctor, but things had not turned out that way. But I knew I could perform a transorbital lobotomy, even if it was in secret. Dr. Freeman stated that he did as many as 30 lobotomies a day sometimes, often with only a humble ice pick. So why not QP? At Tuesday's group session, Dr. B urged us to speak from the heart. There are 11 of us. Eyes are avoided. When it was my turn, my shoulders hunched up and I was staring at my shoes, which are jogging shoes, all stained and rust-colored. I said how ashamed I was to betray the loving trust of my mom and dad, not just once, but many times since the age of 16. I wished I could turn the clock back to infancy, I said, and start time again. When I was pure and good, when I was with God. I said I believed in God, but did not think He believed in me, because I was not worthy. There is a way Mom's face creases and collapses when she cries, and my face collapsed like this, and the guys were embarrassed and looked away. One of them, a cool black jock with a shaved head, passed me a tissue. I was talking fast now, like a runaway trailer truck down a mountain road. Said how sorry I was about the 10-year-old boy I had molested, but did not give such details as that he was black and retarded and a natural zombie, I thought. I said I did not know what had happened, whether I had approached the boy myself in the alley back behind the dumpster where my van was parked, or whether the boy had followed me there and picked me up without my knowing it. Because sometimes things happen to me that I cannot understand. Too fast for me to understand. The boy had demanded money from me or he would tell on me. He demanded $10, and when I gave him $10, he demanded $20, and when I gave him $20, he demanded $50, and when I gave him $50, he demanded $100, which was when I lost control and tried to hurt him. But I did not hurt him, I swear. By this time, I was stammering, and my face was wet with tears, and the guys were looking away from me. But Dr. B asked, had I known this boy for very long, and had I felt affection for him? And I was unable to speak for a while, and then I said, yes, doctor, that is the reason I lost control. After each of our sessions, Dr. B fills out a report for the probation officer, Dr. E and Mr. T also. I am not allowed to see these reports, which are confidential, but often I am told things to make me helpful. Quentin, you are making real progress lately, aren't you? Getting in touch with your emotions, Quentin. A true zombie would be mine forever. He would obey, saying, yes, master, and no, master. He would kneel before me, saying, I love you, master. There is no one but you, master. And so it would be. A true zombie could not say a thing that was not, but only a thing that was. His eyes would be open and clear, but there would be nothing inside them seeing. Nothing passing judgment. Like you who would observe me and who think your own secret thoughts, always and forever passing judgment. A zombie would say, God bless you, master. He would say, F me in the rear end, master, until I bleed blue guts. He would beg. He would be so respectful at all times. He would never laugh or smirk. He would cuddle like a teddy bear. He would rest his head on my shoulder like a baby. Or I would lay my head on his shoulder like a baby. We would lie beneath the covers in my bed in the caretaker's room, listening to the March wind and the bells of the music college tower chiming, and we would count the chimes until we fell asleep at exactly the same moment. I purchased an eye pick, November 1989. Cruising the van along the Lake Michigan shore, I stopped at a little crossroads store and there was no trouble. Nobody seemed suspicious. My fish gutting knife, my 12-inch stainless steel German steak knife, my Swiss Army jackknife, and others of my collection I already had. Began my collection in seventh grade, knowing it would be put to use someday, but not when. Or what use, exactly? Dr. E, who is my personal therapist, paid by Dad, is always asking, "What is the nature of your fantasies, Quentin?" And I am blank and puzzled, blushing like in school when I could not answer a question of my teacher's or even comprehend it. "I don't think I have any what you call fantasies, doctor. I don't know." At the time of Bunny Gloves, Raisin Eyes, Big Guy, I did not have access to my caretaker's quarters and the cellar of 118 Church, but only my van and the two-room place on 12th Street, the tub and the bathroom. My procedures were crude, and I was continually thwarted in my experiments. Bunny Gloves, who I had such hope for, convulsed like a madman when the ice pick entered the top of his left eyeball and screamed through the sponge gag, actually snapping the baling wire securing his ankles. But he did not regain consciousness, dying in 12 minutes. My first zombie, a grade of F. Raisin Eyes lived for 7 hours, sometimes almost conscious, but I had to lift the eyelid of his remaining eye. I only did one and secure it with adhesive tape. Big Guy was the most promising, for by then I had learned to use the ice pick, skillfully aiming the instrument parallel with the bony ridge of the nose, as Dr. Freeman described. Also, Big Guy, for a part black, part Indian dropout basketball player, junkie dealer from Lansing, was healthy. And his bones so long and hard, his muscles, his penis like a length of blood sausage, his skin a deep, rich plum black, I loved to lick with my tongue and gnaw with my teeth. Yet Big Guy disappointed me like the others, for he never regained consciousness in any true sense of the word after the lobotomy and after I removed the gag, breathed deep, shuddering, snoring gasps. I worried they might be heard through the walls of my room if there was anybody to hear them. Big Guy lived approximately 15 hours, dying, I think, as I was effing him in the rear end to discipline him as a zombie. And I only comprehended he was dead when, during the night, waking, needing to take a piss, I felt how cold he was, his arms and legs slung over me as I had arranged them, already stiffened in rigor mortis, so I feared I would be locked in his embrace. My first three zombies, all F's. Yet I did not give up hope, nor have I to this day. Mom called and left a message on the answering tape. At the time, I was up on the second floor using a screwdriver to open the rusted furnace vent in Akhil's room. Akhil is from Calcutta, a physics graduate student, very shy and dark-skinned, and must be in his mid-20s, at least, but looks 15. And his English is so soft and whispery, I have to stoop to hear him, taking care not to make eye contact. "Thank you, mister," he said, and in our mutual awkwardness, I did glance at him, and he was looking at me, his eyes liquidy brown, a glisten in them. My voice sounded American, a little forced, but I believe I said what any caretaker of a rooming house would say. "It's my job." Mom's call got screwed up on the answering tape, erased, asking me, would I like to come for dinner Sunday, probably? Sorry to be missing so many classes at Dale, especially since I am determined to turn over a new leaf this time. And in Intro to Accounting, I effed up the first quiz and missed the second. And since the arrest and the hearing and the suspended sentence, Dad looks at me differently. It's as if he is fearful of me, where before he was impatient and judgmental, as though Q, his only son, were a student failing a course of his. I know he is thinking, no matter the shame to the P family that Q is an admitted sex offender, at least Q is not in the state prison. At least his 10-year-old victim was not injured. Or worse, Dad saying, "It's an investment in our joint future, son," smiling at me with his wrinkly little pink a-hole mouth and his professor eyes narrowed inside his glasses. Mom hugs me and stands on tiptoe to kiss my cheek, and her bones are like dried sticks I could break in my hands. So I stand very straight and still, not breathing to inhale her smell. What that smell is, I do not know and do not name. You know we love you, Quentin, Mom is always saying, like a tape when a button is pushed. This time things will turn out just fine. Then I said, that's right, Mom. I said, I'm sure going to see to that, Mom. Except, I wake up here in my caretaker's bed at the ground floor near 118 Church Street. And I remember my computer class was the day before, or I'm driving out to Dale and it's the wrong day or the wrong time. So I will drive out anyway since the van is in motion headed in that direction, and I am superstitious about changing course on impulse. And if there's a hitchhiker, I will observe him, impersonally contemplating what sort of zombie he might make. But I am not tempted so close to home. And out at the college, which is this crappy fifth-rate business school everybody at the university looks down on, I will park my van and stroll across campus thinking I will visit my profs and tell them there was an illness in the family. But I can't find their offices, or nobody's there when I do, or I get sidetracked trailing some young black guys from my accounting class into the student union, where I'll have a cup of coffee and see who's around, if I recognize anybody or if they recognize me, or even if they don't. I'm carrying my textbooks, and I'm dressed okay, not with my hair in a ponytail any longer since the arrest, though I am wearing Raisin Eyes funky leather slouch-brim hat, and bunny gloves, fur-lined gloves, are in the pocket of my $300 sheepskin coat. And my aviator-style amber prescription sunglasses are a copy of Big Guy's shades. So I look pretty cool, I think, for an ordinary white guy pushing 30, his hairline receding. And it's surprising how friendly the Dale students are and how trusting. All of them commuters like me, living in Mount Vernon or the county. Even a girl will pull out a chair to sit at my table if she sees friends of hers with me, or even if they're not friends exactly. Hi, she'll say, like a high school cheerleader, like the girls in my high school who looked through Coupé like he didn't exist. You're in my computer class, aren't you? I should mention my hand-tooled bronze leather boots, a little big for me, courtesy of Rooster, of last September, Gradiot Avenue in Detroit. I have never selected any specimen, except a black boy I couldn't count from the Roosevelt Projects in Mount Vernon or vicinity. But it is good to keep in practice by speaking with them, though mostly I listen, to learn their words, their slang, the way they move their hands, their mouths, their eyes. Though shrinking from their eyes, sometimes driving one of them home, going a few miles out of my way, it's no trouble, and they will remember my face and the green Ford van with the American flag decal on the back window. A big decal, exactly fitting the back window. If I needed a character witness, for instance, at a trial, I think they would remember QP. If not the name, then the fact that I was kind. Once lent a skinny Chinese kid my sheepskin jacket on a freezing winter night, no questions asked, and he returned it. His name Chow, or Chi with a ping sound somewhere in it, and his eyes shining black. One time, one of them was fighting the drug, his eyes rolling sideways in his head like marbles, saying, "Hey, man, I guess I don't want to do this, okay? Let me go, man." And I told him he could stay for a while. It was all right to stay for a while, and I'd pay him for his trouble. And he said he wouldn't tell anybody if I let him go, but I knew better. And I tightened the cord so his big eyes bulged and his skin was ashy plum and the lips I could not take my eyes off were ashy. And it started shooting through me like electricity. He knows. He's caught on. No turning back. Which is the point that must be reached. The threshold of the black hole that sucks you in. A fraction of a second before and you are free, but a fraction of a second later and you are sucked into the black hole. And my penis hard as a club and big as a club, and the sparks of my eyes, and I did not stammer as I had when first he swung into the van, the cool dude eyeing Whitey. It was two barbiturates I gave him, mashed and in vodka, and I said, "I am not a sadist. I am not a torturer. I think you are terrific. I ask you to cooperate, and you will not be hurt." I was excited. I had to unzip. He saw, And he knew. You know, even when you don't, I will not hurt you, I said, if you lay still. But he was struggling. He was crying. I saw he was just a kid, maybe 19 years old. I jammed the sponge into his mouth so he was almost choking, and I had to be careful. I did not want to lose him. He was tied. He was drugged and should have been anesthetized, but it was taking too long. He was in the tub, naked, and the water was running, and that freaked him. He knows. Knows. Though he did not see the ice pick yet, which I had hidden. Snaky, supple kid with a gold filling and a front tooth, and I'd brought him to the apartment with a promise of home-cooked food and vodka, and he'd be thinking he'd be sucked off by Whitey and paid for his trouble and maybe clear out Whitey's possessions, but that was not how it came about. And the panic in his eyes said that this was so. Reddish, kinky hair, and a red sheen to his skin, like oxblood shoe polish. Good-looking, and he knew it, but it's too late now. I secured his head in the clamp and brought the ice pick to his right eye, lifting the eyelid as Dr. Freeman described. But when I inserted it, he struggled, screaming through the sponge, and there was a gush of blood, and I came. I lost control and came so hard I kept coming and coming like a convulsion. I couldn't stop or even breathe. I was groaning and gasping for air. And when it was over, I was in control again. I saw the damage I had done. The ice pick ran up to the hilt in his eye, up into his brain, and he was dying. He was dead. Another F-up and no zombie. And then the disposal of, the heavy weight of, a downer. Must drive at the speed limit and obey all traffic regulations and must not act suspicious. A landfill or dump is most strategic, of course, where the ground is already broken, and far from the home base, 50, 70, 100 miles. The extra effort is worth it, like buying a new wig, whiskers every time. Vacant lots, wooded areas near parks, risky because kids play in them, but empty marshland beyond the interstate where nobody ever goes is a good bet. How many times? I keep mementos but no records. I memorize what's required and then move on, and sometimes forget. But now I have the basement of this old house. A little sickness in the air from so much fragrance everywhere. Somebody's Left Behind, the new anthology of English verse. I leafed through it in the student union and read these lines, and something rang in me like the bells of the music college, because now it is spring, it is April, and my first year of probation is behind me. The house at 118 Church Street, built 1892, crumbling stone foundation. The cellar was renovated in the 1950s, so there are two sections, the new and the old. The new has a poured concrete floor and reinforced walls with beaver board paneling. The gas furnace is here, water heater, fuse box, caretaker's workbench, and such tools as my electric power drill and Cherokee chainsaw. The old section of the cellar is never used. It has a hard-packed earth floor. The ceiling rafters are low and filthy with cobwebs. Walls rotted. The dry stone cistern, unused for decades. A strong smell of drains and some seepage in the rainy months, but I have installed a second pump. To get back there, you move on your haunches, slowly. You need a good flashlight. You need a will that cannot be broken. The cistern has almost been converted and will be ready for use soon. And if a zombie is a failure, there is the remainder of the cellar for safe disposal in the earth. And there is a new door replacing the old rotted door, and last week I purchased a steel padlock from Sears for extra security. I was allowed to plead guilty to sexual misdemeanor committed against a minor. The lawyer Dad hired for me, and the prosecution lawyer worked it out. And Judge L. was understanding. Where money changes hands, and it is the word of an inexperienced white man, unmarried, 29 years old, against the word of a black boy from the projects, and this black boy, 10 years old, is from a dysfunctional family, there is no problem knowing where justice lies. And QP was repentant. He was ashamed and had learned his lesson. One look at him, you knew. 2 years suspended sentence, psychotherapy, counseling, regular reporting to probation officer Mr. T. Agreed. Leaving Judge L's chambers, I was shaky. I was wiping my face and Dad was gripping me by the elbow. Buck up, son, quote unquote. Everything is fine. Son? And outside, Mom and Ruthie and Reverend Eckhorn, who is Mom's friend and who vouched for me to the authorities, were waiting. And I was wearing a new suit of brown checks, and I was wearing a beige bow tie, and my hair had been cut, trimmed neat at the ears and the nape of the neck. And I was not crying now, but smiling and hugging my family, and I was shaking Reverend Eckhorn's hand, saying, thank you, thank you. I'm so happy, so grateful. Thank you for your faith in me. A warm rain speckled my face. Dad handed me the car keys with a request for me to drive, and I understood it was to show how he trusted me. The family trusted me, and I would not let them down ever again. Driving out of the city to Dale Springs, where the houses are set on large lots and the streets are tree-lined, I felt such a sense of homecoming and being loved. And I kept well within the speed limit, not minding when other drivers honked their horns and passed me impatiently. Ruthie, who is big sis even now, age 35 and principal of a high school, looking after her kid brother, said, Quinn was always the one of us who could drive a car. And then adding quick, I mean is. Right, Quinn? I grinned into the rearview mirror. Right, Ruthie. Driving home, a warm, rainy, windy day, Dad beside me in the passenger seat, stroking his chin where his goatee had been, and Mom and Ruthie in the back. I could almost not remember why I was so happy and feeling so free, thinking of a black penis, shy, shrinking boy penis, like a baby rabbit skinned. I'd held it in my hand, tickling the tip with the tip of the ice pick, but the pills hadn't taken effect yet, and the boy panicked, beginning to bellow even before he broke free and crashed through the locked rear door of the van. So help me God, I don't know how. And running, calling out for help, bellowing like a fire alarm rising louder and louder. My zombie! He had not asked for a nickel, really. He was as trusting as a dog, yet I could not trust him. They were asking me something and I wasn't listening, but I must have answered, okay. Dad laid his hand on my shoulder. For the first time driving that day, I believed I could feel the motion of the earth. The earth rushing through the emptiness of space, spinning on its axis, but you don't feel it. For to feel it is to be scared and happy at once, and to know that nothing matters but that you do what you do, and what you do, you are. And I felt it, and I knew I was moving into the future. There is no past anybody can get to alter things, or even to know for sure what they were. But there is definitely a future. We are already in it. Next, from a critic at large, July 6 and 13, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Unruly Genius of Joyce Carol Oates by Leo Robson. In Joyce Carol Oates' novel, Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, published in 1990, Jinx Fairchild, a star high school athlete, is assigned a 500-word paper on the topic, I Believe. To his surprise, Jinx finds himself endlessly tweaking the essay in a ferocity of concentration, Oates tells us, as single-minded as his concentration on basketball. The aim of this exhausting process is not to sharpen his syntax or to clarify his thinking, but to present the truth as he perceives it and to demonstrate his newfound sense that words on paper can be expressions of the soul. It's hardly a stretch to see an allegory here for his creator's own methods, his approach to composing a credo emerging as a credo in itself. As far back as the novels in Oates' Wonderland Quartet, such as Expensive People, 1968, and Them, 1969, which received the National Book Award 50 years ago this fall, Oates has deployed her zeal for revision to forge a style of rousing roughness. Her dozens of novels and hundreds of short stories, many of them set in Western New York, forego an air of cool mastery in favor of a kind of cultivated vulnerability and openness to engulfment. Human existence in her handling seems a primarily somatic enterprise, and her greedily adjectival prose can sometimes read like a sort of dramatized phenomenology. Even on a bustling city street, her characters can come across as frontiers people or toilers on a polar expedition, as she invokes a world of pounding hearts and thumping ears and watering mouths. She exhibits a refreshing freedom from embarrassment and indifference to the concept of overkill. Oates's friend, the novelist John Gardner, once suggested that she try writing a story, quote, in which things go well for a change, end quote. That hasn't happened yet. Her latest book, the enormous and frequently brilliant Night, Sleep, Death, the Stars, published by Echo, the 49th novel she has published, if you exclude the ones she has written under pseudonyms, is a characteristic work. It begins with an act of police brutality and proceeds to document the multifarious consequences for the victim's wife and children, alcoholism, low-level criminality, marital breakdown, incipient nervous collapse. In a 1977 journal entry, Oates acknowledged that her work turns instinctively toward what she called, quote, the centralizing act of violence that seems to symbolize something beyond itself, end quote. Perhaps the most heavily ironic statement comes in her second novel, A Garden of Earthly Delights, published in 1967, when a woman says, nobody killed nobody, this is the United States, while the most characteristic piece of exposition may be found in Little Bird of Heaven. Daddy was bringing me home on that November evening, not long before his death by firing squad, to a house from which he'd been banished by my mother. Among contemporary American fiction writers, and since the deaths of Philip Roth and Toni Morrison, she possesses a strong claim to preeminence. Oates most clearly displays what Henry James called the imagination of disaster, a faculty or frailty she often gives to her creations. But where James wanted to tame his sense that life was ferocious and sinister, contingent and multiple, Oates taps her feeling of inner chaos as a creative resource. James said that the artist's eternal problem was how to create a geometric pattern that disguises the fact that relations stop nowhere. Oates has talked of the elastic and the fluid. In 1968, she voiced a desire to publish a long work with many characters, many events, a jagged and unclean plot, closely tied in with reality. A formulation that would have kept James awake for months. And whatever the charges that have been leveled at Oates' work, she cannot be accused of failing to realize this ambition. A high-achieving product of 1950s academe, she was the valedictorian of her graduating class at Syracuse University in 1960. Oates rejected what she saw as the prevailing pieties of literary conduct, quote, symmetry, unity of tone, precision, end quote. What distinguishes Oates' record is not just longevity, but doggedness. For a while, she had a kindred spirit in Iris Murdoch, who, around 1970, started writing novels in a mode that Oates called self-consciously Russian, being looser, freer, more ribald, notable for a breathless, plunging, unedited voice and unresolved, troubling, provocative endings. By contrast, Bellow's books became shorter and tidier, and anyway, for all the creative ebullience, the waterfalls of self-displaying energy exhibited in a novel like Humboldt's Gift, his had always been, in Oates's view, an art of accommodation, not terror. And Oates's contemporary Anne Tyler, a one-time grad student in Slavic studies whose early books resembled the meandering of streams, had been seduced by the charms of conventional structure. Oates, all the while, favored the flood over the levee. While striving to curb the mysticism of the books she published in the years after completing the Wonderland Quartet, exorbitant attacks appeared. One by James Wolcott in Harper's was titled, Stop Me Before I Write Again. But despite her view that J.D. Salinger's dignified withdrawal into silence is understandable, given the jeering and dismissive critical response to his last published work, silence was never likely to be her path. Oates' latest novel begins in an intensive care unit with the death of a patriarch. The opening scene takes place on an afternoon in the fall of 2010 when Whitey McLaren, a 67-year-old businessman and one-time mayor of Hammond, New York, pulls off the highway near his hometown, just behind a grimy and graffiti-defaced overpass, to approach a pair of patrol cops in the process of attacking a dark-skinned young man, and is beaten up and then tased. Trying to rise, oh, but his heart is pounding hard. From this briskly brutal scene, Oates spins a 780-page portrait of rumination, recrimination, and renewal. Night, Sleep, Death, the Stars. The title comes from Whitman, is a novel of aftermath, an epilogue drawn to epic length, the story of what happens to a group of people robbed of their linchpin or anchor. We Were the Mulvaneys was a rare among Oates' book in using a single first-person narrator. The new novel is written in her favored roaming third person and is told from more than a half dozen perspectives. There are the two McLaren sons, Tom in his late 30s, the second in command at McLaren Inc., a commercial printer that long ago diversified, and the runt of the litter, Virgil, a 31-year-old artist and dropout. There are three daughters, Beverly, prom queen turned board housewife, Laureen, local high school principal, and Sophia, a pharmaceutical lab assistant, as well as Jessalyn, their beloved mommy. Whitey's death sends the remaining McLarens into various crises, prompting Sophia, for example, to re-examine everything she previously knew, from familiar roads to professional habits. She no longer feels comfortable killing animals for lab tests. Family life is a suitable subject for a novelist with Oates' emphases, as well as serving as a mirror of Moore's, a site for drama and violence, a battleground, in the words of one character. It is also an occasion for sensory description, challenging the writer to convey what the psychoanalyst R.D. Lang called, quote, the texture, the taste, one might say, end quote, of familial experience. The family unit is also a breeding ground for myth. You may have thought our family was larger, Judge Mulvaney recalls. In the new novel, it isn't long before we discover that there's more to Whitey McLaren than his good-natured and approachable persona. Oates' habits are designed to unsettle us, and though pleasure is never out of the equation, the novel avoids many traditional narrative strategies for ginning up tension. The reader is shown, long before any of the surviving characters are, the circumstances of the novel's central narrative event. Whitey's roadside encounter with the Hammond police is presented as answers to a series of factual questions. Why did he pull over? Where had he been driving from? And a character can be introduced with the syntactic equivalent of a four-car pileup. Just a glance at Tom McLaren, tall and rangy-limbed, sandy-haired, handsome face now, just perceptibly beginning to thicken in his late 30s. Virgil often stared when he believed Tom wasn't aware of him. You could see that. Tom was one of those persons who feels very good about himself, and his self-estimate is largely shared by those who gaze upon him. And yet there is great joy to be derived from the novel's submerged patterns, its mind-boggling fecundity, its gallimaufry of devices, its combination of intricacy and lucidity. An early chapter called The Seed moves from the McLaren children waking up in the family home via some reflections on sibling order, to an unsituated flashback of Virgil explaining that he wants to drift like a cottonwood seed, and his father telling him that a seed is supposed to take root and grow. The evocation of an extended period, in his 20s he disappeared for weeks, months at a time, then settles into a dramatic scene, a debate between Virgil and Whitey on the concept of use. Whitey thinks that we are here on earth to be of use, while Virgil wants to know what kind of use, for whose use, at what price to the user. The debate in which Jessalyn intervened gently is seen from various perspectives. Sophia, usually Virgil's ally, hopes this time that their father will rebuke him. The McLaren siblings collectively notice that Virgil never seems hurt by Whitey's remarks. Virgil thinks that was unfair and inaccurate, and Whitey feels frustrated that he cannot defeat his own son in argument, while regretting that he had agreed to give him that eccentric name. Quote, Not likely that he'd have such frustrating experiences with a son named Matthew, end quote. The rest of the chapter canters through Virgil's past, loving poetry and painting as a dreamy child, enrolling at Oberlin College and then leaving, accepting a teaching job in North Hammond, and then resigning, struggling to articulate his philosophy of extreme altruism, and slipping into codependency with Jessalyn. Quote, "You are enabling our son," Whitey tells her, using a piece of newly acquired jargon. Then we slip back into the family's bedside vigil. Although Oates rejects cohesion as a formal virtue, she has a coherent vision of what literature can deliver. She believes in the itching and the ornery and the oddly shaped, and has been trying to produce fiction that feels as irreducible to simple meanings, as resistant to paraphrase as the subject matter it portrays. The heroic figures in Night, Sleep, Death, the Stars are Jessalyn and Hugo Martinez, and perhaps above all, Virgil. The other McLaren siblings represent a bullying orthodoxy, like the tradition-oriented critics of the 50s. He doesn't care at all that Daddy is seriously ill, an unnamed McLaren says of Virgil, while Beverly claims that some part of Virgil's brain is missing, the part that is sensitive to social cues. The four-page scene that follows, beginning, "Hi, Dad," makes it clear that Virgil cares as much as anybody. At one point, he takes a deep breath, lifts a handmade woodwind instrument to his mouth, and produces, Oates tells us, a series of earnest, breathy notes, so airy you couldn't define them as flute sounds. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.